This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 24th of November 2009, our guest was Professor Giuseppe Fontana of the University of Leeds, who spoke about his recent book, Money, Uncertainty and Time. Our discussant was Dr. Alberto Feduzzi of the Judge Business School, Cambridge. You can download PowerPoint slides to accompany the talk from the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thanks very much, Mark, for the nice introduction. It's a great pleasure, actually, to be in Cambridge again. And I should start, actually, taking this opportunity, if you allow me, to thank Jeff Harker that is here in the audience, because I don't think this book will ever be published without the encouragement of Jeff to pursue this long-term project. I should say something about the nature of this book. I was telling you before that this is a very important book for me because it is a way in which summarize, if you want, what I've been doing in the last 10, 50 years maybe. It was a way in which I will explain to myself before then to the audience, to the potential readers, how I could put together some research, interesting research stream in Keynesian economics. I didn't talk very often actually about this book, so you will forgive me if I don't have a certain, the usual enthusiasm. I feel a bit difficult to talk about this book because I said it represents so much of myself that is not easy in 40 minutes, that is quite a long time, but even 40 minutes to tell the message that are in this book. So I will say that this is the content of the book, and you will see there are three parts, and I will tell you a bit about three parts, but you can see the running theme is this link between money, uncertainty, and time. In chapter one, I make some, quite strong claim. I start with the idea that Keynesian economics, broadly defined, because we know that Keynesian economics means different things to different people, but if you think that we can define Keynesian economics as the theoretical approach that seeks inspiration in Keynes' writings, I discuss the contribution and I made the claim that Keynesian economics has made important contribution in our discipline, and as the recent event have shown, it remains a driving force in the development of new theory and method of analysis. I say that this profound vitality of Keynesian economics confirm that what Keynes wrote and some of his ideas are still relevant today, though the historical circumstances have changed. I go to explain what I mean by Keynesian economics, because said one thing that I found is that Keynesian economics means different things for different individuals. So I use three propositions to represent what I believe are Keynesian, the heart of Keynesian economics. And the three propositions you can read is the possibility of involuntary unemployment, the principle of effective demand, and the principle of policy effectiveness. I think those three propositions, in my view, highlight the dissenting nature of Keynesian economics. In other words, I argue that Keynesian economists are dissenters of the traditional or the characteristic neoclassical proposition that market economies automatically self-adjust to the full level of employment, the output. And I think these three propositions allow to distinguish, if you want, Keynesian economics from neoclassical economics, but also allows, and I think this is very important, to see the different version of Keynesian economics. So in other words, what I'm arguing especially in chapter one, is A, Keynesian economists are the center of the traditional neoclassical proposition that the market self-adjusts toward the full employment level output. So there is here a distinction between Keynesian neoclassical economics. But those propositions also helpful to distinguish the different contribution of a Keynesian economist. And here again, I made maybe a controversial claim, is that I think from Keynes' 1936 book, Keynesian economists have always had to confront themselves with this dilemma. How much we retain in our writings of classical economics, how much we reject it. And I think different authors have proposed a different answer to that question. In order to suggest that this is a question that starts with Keynes himself, I mean, Jeff is here in the audience, and he often mentioned this quote to me, in which Keynes say, I quote, "If our central control succeed in establishing an aggregate volume of output corresponding to full employment as nearly as is practicable, the classical theory comes into his own again from this point onwards." So it was Keynes himself that in some way tried to claim that there was a link between his theory and the classical theory. And I think this position toward classical economics and then neoclassical economics has always been an important feature of the historical development of Keynesian economics. In particular, I focus in chapter one on different interpretation of the Keynesian descent, and I highlight two, if you want. The one that I think are more relevant in modern terms is the new Keynesian interpretation of the Keynesian descent and the post-Keynesian descent. I like this because, of course, post-Keynesian economics provide a broader framework to organize my writings and my contribution. I also have to acknowledge that what has prevailed in the last 20 years as an interpretation of Keynesian economics is new Keynesian economics. And indeed, I mean, I'm sure some people maybe in the audience are aware of that the Review of Political Economy is organizing a symposium on the memory of John Cornwall writings. And I was asked by the editor to write a paper for that symposium. And one of the lessons I think I learned from John Cornwall was that there are varieties of Keynesian economists. There has been one prevalent view for several decades, but it's not the only view. And what he put forward was a different view, the view of many people probably in this audience, that is different from new Keynesian economics. I think at this particular historical moment it's important to remind ourselves that yes, Keynesians are dissenting economists, but there are different forms of that dissent. As we all know, new Keynesian, or the new consensus, that is, if you want, the evolution of new Keynesian economics, has been the main approach in macroeconomics for the last 20 years. And now we all debate about the failure of the new consensus in macroeconomics. And I think there is a time to think about how these new Keynesian interpretations fail to provide, for instance, an explanation of the nature of the current situation and the fail to propose solution to the current economic situation. And maybe there is a chance for alternative views of Keynesian economics to be discussed, at least. And I think in that sense, these three propositions allow that type of discussion because they do highlight the similarities between the different approach in Keynesian economics, but also socio-stress differences. I mean, going back to this distinction between the new Keynesian and post-Keynesian economics, that is, I think, something that is quite important today is this idea that you can separate Keynesian economics from classical economics in terms of a theoretical framework based on a time view. In other words, in the short run, we are Keynesian. In the long run, we are classical. I'm not saying this is necessarily a problem, but in the light of what has happened today, I think we need to ask if that was a way of interpreting Keynes and Keynes' writings. I think everyone even if people have believed in that particular interpretation of Kant's writings, must ask the question, is this the way of framing the dissent in Keynesian economics, this separation between Keynesian issues in the short run and the classical approach in the long run? And I think it's an historical moment, I think it's an important moment to discuss these things. And having on the other side, you have a different interpretation provided by, you can call Cambridge Keynesian or, you know, post-Keynesian if you want to use a more encompassing words, in which the Keynesian dissent starts from the first principles. And that's what I like there, that I think those principles then are reflected in your theoretical framework and your methodology. And I believe, but I may be wrong, it's in my personal interpretation, three principles that are sort of been important in the evolution of this post-Keynesian dissent is money, uncertainty, and time. And that's why I use as the title of my book, Money, Uncertainty, and Time. I'm not saying that the contribution under these three principles have been necessarily consistent with each other, but I do think that they highlight the link between theory and methodology. So what I do, as I said, there are different parts in the book, and I hope that what I can do in the next few minutes is to provide some interest in the book so you can go and read it, because I don't think I can summarize all these ideas. As I said, there is a lot of myself in this book, and the way in which I thought I was writing in the last 10 years. So I hope I will convey at least some of the ideas. In part one, I set the frame of reference for the rest or remaining chapter of the book. And it deals with, as you can see in chapter two, the historical development of dissent in Keynesian economics. In particular, I look at one form of dissent, that is post-Keynesian economics, and I look not only at the success, but also at the failures. And this was difficult in some way to write this chapter, because it is sometimes difficult to look at what didn't work. And, I mean, you know, there is here is a prestigious audience, so they will tell me what is missing from this reconstruction. It is a reconstruction, as there are many. And I highlight that two different periods that I labeled the Romantic Age and the Age of Uncertainty. I think in the 1960s and 1970s there was these very romantic ideas, if you want, in the light of what has happened later on, that post-Keynesian economics could provide a theoretical system alternative to the neoclassical system. So there was this search for a grand theoretical system. Unfortunately, we all know that that search didn't lead to a successful overtaking of the neoclassical system. And then I think that's what started with this age of uncertainty. There was an idea that maybe we didn't have to look only at the theoretical framework, but also at the alternative methodology that could ground these theoretical claims of post-Keynesian economics. I think at the beginning the debate was very healthy, because highlight, as I said, the fact that when you write about Keynesian economics, you have to think not only in terms of theory, but also in terms of methodology. And this distinction maybe is not often clear, for instance, in other Keynesian school. New Keynesian economics usually adopted very much classical approach, try to achieve the Keynesian result of involuntary unemployment. So there is there space for a debate about the contradiction in ignoring this message. But I also think that what we have learned is that this age of uncertainty has highlighted problems within the post-Keynesian approach. There was a time in the book I do mention that there were too many isms. You know, there was Kaleskianism, there was Sraffianism, there was post-Keynesianism, institutionalism. There were too many isms. And I do think that we need to learn lessons from that. For instance, now there is an historical opportunity you know, to present an alternative view of macroeconomics. But if we don't communicate between ourselves, if we don't sort of engage with current writings in macroeconomics, there is a risk to be sort of, you know, left behind. And I think I discussed that in chapter 2 with quite a view of a positive view that we may learn lessons that are useful for the future. So it's not only an historical reconstruction, but it's also something that may help our future. Chapter 3, if you want, is a case study. I look at chapter 18 of the general theory of in order to represent what Keynes was saying compared to the classics, and highlight this relationship between theory and method in Keynes' writings. I think it's very important that, as I said before, maybe in the 80s there was possibly too much stress on methodology, but we shouldn't take, sort of, you know, we shouldn't ignore that methods is an important part of Keynes' writing and of post-Keynesian writing. So we should move beyond, sort of, you know, that debate, to take the positive with us, but that, you know, there is this clear link between theory and methods that highlight Keynes' writings. And I look at chapter 18 to see what is this particular link. And I can only say that, you know, I do believe that the post-Keynesian interpretation of the Keynesian descent does highlight this intimate link between methodology and theory. Chapter 4 is the beginning of part 2 of the book, and is concerned more with the theoretical element of the book. It builds actually on what I was just saying before, on the particular nature of the link between the theory and methodology in Keynes and post-Keynesian economics. And it deals with notion of rationality, probability relation, knowledge. And here I try to build on this sort of, you know, well-established contribution to understand two theoretical contributions, basically the theory on employment proposed by some post-Keynesian economics. I use Paul Davidson theory as an example, or Jan Kregel theory as an example. And the other side, I use the monetary circuit theory of Graziani, Parguez, again as an example of a different way of interpreting Keynes' writing. Chapter 4, as I said, built this two-dimensional theory of probability and knowledge. I'm sure this is where Alberto, my discussion, probably will illuminate my my contribution, because he's an expert of this field. What I try to do there is to use this theory of probability of knowledge developed by Keynes and Keynes scholars, and try to relate to a theory. How successful, maybe Alberto will tell me, but I was trying to relate, as I said, the method, the theory of knowledge that is in Keynes and Keynes scholar writings with more practical issues. For instance, those writing relate to the work of circuitist, for instance, or the work of writer like Davidson and Kregel, or Jeff Harcourt, for instance. Here there is, I'm sure, probably, as I said, Alberto will discuss a bit more about this this table. I must say here, I go back to my master, and I would say that I was trying to be perfectly right. I was roughly right. I mean, I was trying to summarize this literature, presenting this two-dimensional theory of probability and related forms of knowledge. You can see that there are four different forms of knowledge, broadly speaking, what I call the certainty. Then we have risk, uncertainty one, uncertainty two. Those forms of knowledge are grounded on a degree of rational belief, probabilities, and weight of argument. And so you can go from a situation which you have a probability equal to 1 with a high level of weight of argument, and so to describe certainty to the most extreme Davinsonian, if you want, world in which you have a non-existent degree of rational belief, so probability does not exist, and weight of argument does not exist, so you have uncertainty too. Okay, and what I try to do is, sorry for that, is then to relate this form of uncertainty to a particular economic theory. I'll tell you in a second, is I relate that to the theory of unemployment, but I also find that between certainty and risk, there are much more sort of, you know, mainstream view of forms of knowledge, and this more radical view, Shackleian, we have a Shackle scholar here, form of knowledge that is uncertainty two. There is also some things I call uncertainty one. And here again, there has been writing about these issues, but I think most people have felt obliged almost to highlight the difference between the mainstream notion of risk and sort of, you know, the radical or Shackleian, Robinsonian view of uncertainty that I called here uncertainty two. And they forgot that between these two cases, there is some things in which the degree of rational belief, so in other words, probability, do exist, are between 0 and 1, but there is a weight of argument that is very low, and the practical implication of that is that individuals will have a problem in the way in which they behave, and this here, there is a link with the role of institution, contract, for instance. And I relate to this form of uncertainty that is not as radical as uncertainty, but still much more radical than the notion of risk in mainstream to the theory of the monetary circuit. And again, here, I think this is may have upset some of my friends in the monetary circuit, because people like, for instance, Mario Seccarecce, that has made very important contribution on the monetary circuit. They were skeptical at the beginning about this claim that uncertainty could play a role in the monetary circuit. I try to be not critical, I try to be propositive here, and what I was arguing is that if uncertainty is so important in Keynes' writing, and as highlighted by a scholar of like Jeff Harcourt, Robinson, Paul Davidson, Vicky Cheek, and Jan Kregel, how it could be irrelevant for other Keynesian writings like the one of The Circuitist. And I was suggesting there may be another or a slightly different notion of uncertainty, what I called here uncertainty one, that may highlight or may provide the knowledge base for that type of theories. And I think now some of the circuitists have accepted that view, and indeed they have made a much more important contribution probably than I did in developing this idea. But I do think that was quite interesting for myself, again, to explain how I could put together two different type of Keynesian writings together with this work on uncertainty that was made in the 1980s, you know, with especially people in Cambridge, you know, Tony Lawson, for instance, Jochen Rund, they were working on these things, how this work could be related to the theories that other people were working on at the same time. Okay? And indeed, in chapter 5, I sort of discuss these issues in details, and I explain how uncertainty 2, what I call uncertainty 2, is very much related to a particular theory of money as a store of wealth, which leads to a theory of involuntary unemployment that is different from that particular interpretation of Keynesian economics that I labeled before, New Keynesian economics. At the same time, I looked at another notion of uncertainty, what I called before uncertainty one, how it's related to a different theory of money as a final means of payment, in the way in which Graziani, for instance, has discussed this, and how it relates to the monetary circuit and the description of the production process and the speculative process. And again, here there is a table in which I try to summarize this. So you can see the theoretical implication of uncertain knowledge. So you can see uncertainty one leads to a particular view of the function of money, in particular stress rule of money as a final means of payment, and how that particular form of knowledge and rule of money then highlighted the modern theory of the monetary circuit. And, you know, if you want There is this wonderful book by Augusto Graziani that summarized the contribution of the monetary circuit. And I do think that the notion of uncertainty I discussed there may certainly provide a stronger epistemological knowledge claim, if you want, to that type of theoretical arguments. At the same time, I try to stress that it isn't inconsistent. Actually, it is very much consistent with another notion of uncertainty that, as I like the work, as I said before, of Cambridge economist or Jan Kregel, Davidson, that or radical uncertainty, fundamental uncertainty, as you want to call it, which has led to highlight the role of money as a store of wealth, and which, as a result of this particular view on money, has funded the modern theory of voluntary unemployment. I can only highlight the features. I will not go into the details of the theory, but you see what I'm claiming here is that uncertainty, there are different ways in which you can represent uncertainty, which lead to different theories of money, which then lead to different post-Keynesian theoretical framework. On one side you have the monetary circuit, on the other side you have the theory of involuntary unemployment. Here, for instance, I highlight the monetary circuit, how indeed it's a very simplistic representation of the monetary circuit, but how it's important that, for instance, uncertainty, the role played uncertainty in this circuit. And here I draw on the writings of scholars that have highlighted the fact that our economy is a capitalist economy, not a cooperative economy. If we could establish from the beginning the reward for the contribution of all input, then we will be in a different world. The idea that firms approach banks in order to get the loans, as represented in this circuit, in order to buy labor services, and so to get in this contractual arrangement, it's based, I believe at least, on the view that we live in a world of uncertainty, and so we need to sign a contract to take into account that the outcome of our plan, in this case, could be challenged by different historical circumstances. So we need to prevent surprise in that sense created by the system of uncertainty. Finally, part three of the book applies the set of ideas and notions that I discuss in part two to the modern debate of endogenous money theory. That's what Mark Hayes was mentioning before, is where I made some contribution. And I should say that in the last few years, what I try to do is to build on this endogenous money theory and to see what it means in terms of policy implication. And here I explore the role of monetary policy, the role of fiscal policy in an endogenous money world, how that compare with the current new consensus in macroeconomics, and so on. So this part three, it's only the beginning, if you want, of my recent writing on the endogenous money theory. And in chapter six, I look at the writings of John Hicks, the early Hicks, as well as the late and more critical Hicks. As Jeff Ark always reminds, there are two Hicks here. And in particular, I look at this interesting distinction that Hicks put forward between a single peer theory and a continuation theory. I always find Hicks, it's a difficult author. It's the father of the ISLM, that if you want is, again, a particular interpretation of Keynes' writings that is not very popular with people in this audience. I understand and I share some the concern. But at the same time, I will also say that Hicks has consistently, over his entire career, tried to struggle with this idea of money and time, how I could put together these two principle. And he has answered the questions of money and time in different way over time, and I think, you know, you can see that he was not happy with the solution that he provided in his early writings. He went back on the same issues. His last book was about money and time again. What I pick up in particular is this distinction between single period and continuation theory. The reason for that is that in chapter 7 I use that distinction to present the debate between the accommodationist or horizontalist endogenous money theorist and the structuralist endogenous money theory. But let me tell you what is the basic distinction between a single period and continuation theory. Here the idea is that if you want a way which you can start to discuss this complex relationship between money and time is to start with an assumption that the state of expectation of the agents involved in the money supply process are given. Now, that allows you to get the key causality process in place. So you will understand, for instance, in particular, what is the nature of money, how money is introduced in our economy, how it's certainly circulated in our economy. And then you look at the continuation theory. In other words, you allow for the fact that the state of expectation of agents can change as a result of the behavior of agents in the money supply process. And when you allow for that, things get a bit more complicated. Maybe I should immediately move to chapter 7, because there you will see what I mean. A single period theory, I think it's essential, for instance, in understanding what is the role of money in our economy. It is not a veil, okay? It's an important, essential component of our economy. It tells you how money is introduced and tells you some things about the causality of money and price. So the single period theory will allow you to challenge head-on the quantity theory of money, for instance, money, it's a cause of the change in the price, okay, in our economy. It's, as endogenous money theorists have highlighted, the other way around. What I'm arguing, the single period theory may sort of provide a framework, a time framework, which will allow to understand the contribution of what I called the horizontalist the accommodationist analysis, depending on the way you want to call it. In particular, they will allow you to understand the two main tenets of that theory, that is, loans create deposit, and deposit make reserves. And in chapter 7, actually, I go through these different contributions using graphical analysis, a balance sheet analysis. I should acknowledge here that it's not only my own contribution, but I try actually to summarize the contribution of individuals drawing on this single period analysis. So, I happily acknowledge indeed the wonderful contribution of Basil Moore. Basil, I think it's the grandfather of all endogenous money theorists. What I found is sometimes that the contribution of Basil were misunderstood or led to a dead end, because people start to ask how really is the best way to represent endogenous money theory. Well, I think if you think in terms of single period analysis, you can understand what horizontalists are trying to do, and how, for instance, structuralists, they came after the horizontalists, trying to reach that theoretical framework. So think in terms, as I said, on the state of expectation of agents as given. So, for instance, you consider how money is introduced in the economy under the assumption that the state of expectation of the central bank, firms, household, financial market are all given. What the structuralists have done through the analysis of liquidity preference, and Bibel, for instance, written a wonderful book recently about these issues, is how those state of expectation of those agents change as a result of the money supply process. In other words, as a result of the creation of new credit, and therefore and new loans, there will be possibly change in the state of expectation of those agents. And what does it mean in terms of the behavior of the commercial banks, as I said, the central bank, the business sector, and the household sector? And that's how I use this single period continuation distinction of Hicks to explain the contribution of horizontalist and structuralist. And here you will see some balance sheet analysis. Mark Hayes kindly tells me that I have not more than a few minutes left, so I'm sure most people in this room are familiar with the debate, but I'm very happy to go back on these tables and these issues later on. You can see not only the role of money in these tables, but you also see the role of trust, and in particular the role of the central bank as the last supply of liquidity. So I call the supply of last resort of liquidity to the economy. And maybe 4 or 5 years ago, this was a controversial claim. I think not today, as Mervyn King reminded us, without inverted Bank of England, Royal Bank of Scotland, and HSBC will have been in serious trouble last year. So I will just leave it behind. Let me just conclude that in Chapter 8, I try to put things all together and try to provide, in a very, I will say, approach to what Keynes meant by general theory, so a theory that relies on as, you know, a very few restrictive assumptions, a theory of endogenous money that draws on the contribution of horizontalists and structuralists, providing, if you want, a single period continuation interpretation of the controversial issues between horizontalists and structuralists. This is a graphical analysis again. I'm very up to go back on these issues, and you will see that actually this graphical analysis, for instance, I recently asked to use to explain the financial crisis, and I use this actually to explain how, for instance, I'm sure the people that are listening to this talk may look at figure 8.1 in the slides or in the book. And basically, the way you can explain the nature of the financial crisis to shift in what we call the L0As, so in other words, in the supply of loans, in this case, you can have a change in the markup over the base rate. Okay, that's what is happening now. Commercial banks, basically, if you want, they are changing the markup over the base rate. So despite the fact that the base rate of the central bank is going down, the markup is going up, and that will explain upward shift of your loan supply curves. And again, you can explain some of the issues discussed in the financial crisis in terms of a shift of the proportion of business and household loans they are deemed creditworthy. That will explain a shift in your demand for loans. And again, this is a way to explain in very simple way how endogenous money theory can provide an argument or some sort of understanding of what happened with the financial crisis. And Mark Setterfield and I have just edited a book that draws on this idea, in which you use modern endogenous money theory to highlight current issues, including financial crisis, and how you can use that theory for teaching purposes. So again, you know, the claim I made at the beginning, that Keynesian economics, it's a driving force of modern economics. It's not only something that happened in the 1930s or maybe 1940s and 50s, still an important driving force. But I want to use to conclude is that there are different ways in which you can frame the dissent in Keynesian economics. The last 20 years has been a particular interpretation of dissent. It's a new Keynesian economics. Many people in this audience will be uncomfortable with that audience. What I'm saying is try to explain that there is this different way of expressing dissent in Keynesian economics. It's called like post-Keynesian economics that can be useful at different levels, and it certainly can inform the current debate on how to challenge the new consensus in macroeconomics. I know I abuse the patience of my chair, so I will stop here, but I'll be very happy to listen what Alberto has to say and respond to questions from the audience. Thanks very much.